I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota.
Good evening, voice of Ashland. This is Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies. Welcome to the show. And I have a special guest this evening, a gentleman named Steve Bergman. He is a geologist who lives not here on Vashon, but tell us a little bit about yourself, Steve.
Well, I've retired after a career in the exploration research industry and moved to Vashon.
Where were you before? Where were you working?
We moved from Houston, Texas. Mm-hmm. My two daughters were both born in Dallas.
That's a fun city.
And we lived the last part of our time in Texas in Houston before moving to Vashon.
Is that where you're originally from?
No, originally we're from Ohio.
Oh, nice.
Mary and I were both born in Ohio and Dayton,
I'm also
Cincinnati.
A fellow Midwesterner.
Great.
Yeah.
It's a great place to be from, in my opinion.
I agree. I will be going there on Sunday, though. It's a little cold, but, you know.
Yeah.
It's good. It's good.
Freezing.
So this Cats and Jammer Follies is a travel show. And today, we're not going to necessarily talk about any particular travel. However, we're going to travel the world and talk about terroir, which is, I'm going to let Steve talk about that because I won't do any justice with it, but it is part of the production of wine making, wine growing, grape growing. Correct me, Steve.
No, you're right on the money. It turns out that you can apply terroir to anything. It can be applied to anything that we grow, like apples and oranges.
Oh, so it isn't just grapes.
It isn't just grapes, but grapes have started the whole idea of terroir because the French actually sort of developed this whole idea many, many hundreds of years ago because they figured out that certain plots created much better wine than other plots.
And, I can imagine. Different regions.
And so they started limiting the production to individual parcels. And then they figured out that, well, really, this can be applied anywhere in the world. And it's because terroir is a combination of all these factors, the soil, the bedrock underneath the soil, the altitude of the vineyard,
mm-hmm.
the climate, the weather, microbes living in the soil, vegetation around. Are there eucalyptus trees or is lavender? Are there other fragrant types of plants growing in the vineyard?
Do you know any specific wines that we might find here that are grown with this terroir?
Well, every wine, strictly speaking, has its own terroir by definition.
Okay.
So it's a characteristic. And winemakers are now figuring out that the more they know about their terroir, the better. For instance, the rocks of Milton Freewater, have you heard about that appellation in eastern Washington that was just granted about 10 years ago? It is this extremely unique terroir, these huge boulders of basalt that formed this huge fan during about the last ice age. And the Syrah that's grown on the rocks of Milton Freewater is like no other Syrah around. If you compare the Syrah right next door from a vineyard that grows the grapes on Luss, this fine windblown dust, the wines are totally different, just right next to a door.
And you called the other one Luss?
Luss, L-O-E-S-S. It's a type of windblown dust during the last ice age. We had all these glaciers giving us all these glacial lakes, and all the dust that settled out in the lakes, the winds blew them. And there's huge loess deposits out in eastern Washington, and you can find them all over the world.
And does that also produce good grapes, or just completely different?
Not different. It's the loess is really fine. It's a clay and silt, and so it's not those materials aren't the best for growing vines in.
So have you yourself gone to like France and gone to different vineyards?
Yeah,
and
I've visited a lot around the world in New Zealand and Australia and
tell
France.
Tell us about where you've gone and the wines that you've tasted there.
So I've visited a lot of the wineries in the United States, all over Eastern Washington. My daughter went to Whitman College, so we got to visit Walla Walla.
Oh, that's great.
Many times over a 4-year period, and visited. They've got 180 wineries now in Walla Walla.
Yeah, it's really
it's
happening.
Amazing. So we've visited all those. We just recently, the Geological Society of America had a terroir tour of Washington vineyards, and we toured around about a dozen different vineyards and tasted the wine out in the vineyard. And talked about the geology. I mean, the beauty is when it's all about place, right?
Yeah.
We're all realizing that place is really important. And the grapes recognize this too.
They would have to.
But I've toured.
They're obviously getting fed better with the terroir than it seems other, like, what was the other word that you said?
The loess.
Loess.
That's just a unique type of soil that you see out in Eastern Washington. But yeah, the California vineyards are fantastic. Napa Valley and Sonoma.
Where's your favorite wine from? Do you yourself have, I mean, you said earlier you're not the biggest wine drinker, but what would be like your preferred?
I like drinking wine, but
you're not alone, Steve.
My favorites are Zinfandel and Syrah.
From where?
The Syrah's from Eastern Washington, actually.
Oh, nice. So you like
Cayuse,
the big
if you've
reds.
Ever tried Cayuse. I like big reds.
Yeah.
I like Bordeaux blends. I'm not really a Pinot kind of guy. I don't know about you and Pinot, but
I do like Pinot.
It's the barnyard thing that doesn't really do it for me.
So are you saying I'm lowbrow?
No, I mean, it's unique. That's the beauty of wine. You know, everyone, there's nothing right or wrong. Everyone has their own taste.
Everybody does, yeah. My husband and I went through a big wine drinking phase, but we kind of just drink more beer now. But when we do travel, like we for sure, we just came back from a month in Europe and in the fall, where we were in Greece, where we drank tons and tons of white wine, and in Croatia, the same, lots of white wine, different kinds, a lot of really lighter ones, I think, is what is offered there. Italy, of course, we went to a beautiful vineyard and got a tour by the gentleman who owns it and produces the grapes, so that was really special.
Nice.
Yeah, it was really amazing, actually.
Did you make it east and into Georgia or...
No, I wish. I would love to go there.
Armenia?
No, not yet.
So I've been teaching these seminars at the wine shop for Liz, and we've done two of them so far. One on Slovakia, and the second one was on Georgia and Armenia. Because that's the cradle of wine civilization. It turns out that's where all the grapes, the Vitis vinifera, derive based on the DNA from that part of the world.
Oh, that's amazing.
Over
we better not tell those Italians.
8,000 years ago, they found evidence in the archaeological record of grapes being grown and wine being made. They found these jugs, these pots with seeds, wine, grape seeds in them.
In Armenia.
In Armenia and Georgia. And they have an amazing method. They have a lot of amber wines in Georgia and Armenia because they take the seeds and the skins and they ferment the wine with the grapes and skins intact. And it makes the white wine turns this amber color.
It sounds beautiful.
It's really orange, but they don't like calling it orange because then it might be confused with orange juice.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. So you've gone to Georgia?
No, I haven't. But we taste the wines then. She imports them.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize she had wines from Georgia.
She's got some fantastic wines.
I haven't been in there since they did the trade off.
From Julie to Liz.
From Julie, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess it's kind of been a minute.
And now she's going to move. So she's moving over to Micah's
place. Heard that. Yeah. That's awesome.
So she's going to have a much larger area. She's going to serve food.
Great.
And we're going to do another one coming up in March, the end of March, on the highest altitude wines in the world.
Which are from where?
Salta in Argentina.
I do like Argentinian wines.
Yeah. Mendoza and Salta have the highest altitude. There are high vineyards in Tibet, but they don't really produce much.
I was going to say, do they produce
not
red
much.
Wine in Tibet?
Just a little bit. And they're just, and China is starting to produce a lot of wine, but it hasn't really made it
exported. Oh,
yet.
Interesting. Steve, you were going to say that some of the, what were you talking about, the wines that came from Slovenia?
Oh, yes. Slovenia has some fantastic wines, too. And so this whole belt from Italy through the Alps to the east, you have the Dinaride mountain belt.
Yeah.
And then as you go east on the south coast of the Black Sea, you go through the Pontides, and then you pick up the Caucasus. And the Caucasus, between the Black Sea and Caspian Sea, is where you have Georgia and Armenia. And that's another mountain belt that results from continent-continent collision, where two plates collided, form these huge mountains, and that gives us the topography, the relief that we need to get the right climate conditions and these beautiful south-facing slopes in the northern hemisphere for the grapes to grow on. They like the north-facing slopes.
God, you make it sound so beautiful.
And that's the beauty of it. People are realizing that it's not an accident that has produced these beautiful wines, but the combination of all the natural processes and geologic evolution that has given us what we have. It's amazing.
And I'm trying to remember if I'm remembering this correctly. Like, I have a friend who spent time in India, and she said they're really starting to produce wines there. Is that true?
Really?
I don't know
if I haven't heard about India.
Remembering that,
so
or not.
It turns out that wine grapes grow best in two zones of latitude, where the temperatures during the growing season go from about 12 degrees centigrade to 22 degrees centigrade,
mm-hmm.
and that limits us to about 30 to 50 degrees north and south latitude. So there are these two strips on the globe that really are the best places to grow wine grapes. You can grow them anywhere. I mean, they grow grapes in Hawaii, but you need very special circumstances because there's humidity and mildew problems. You know, you get a lot of problems if there's high humidity. So, I mean, there's all these climate indicators. Like, you want cool nights, warm days. You want a lot of sun, so the grapes can really generate a lot of sugar. You want a lot of photosynthesis to make all the sugars. And the more sugar you have, then the more alcohol you could produce during the fermentation. And then if you're at very high altitudes, it turns out that there's a lot more ultraviolet radiation coming from the sun, and the skins get thicker to protect the seeds from getting damaged from the UV radiation.
Sure, that makes sense.
And it gives the grapes all this added, the phenols and all these microchemicals that give you unique flavors because of just the environment.
Wow. We have a friend that makes wine on Vashon, and it gets the grapes in Eastern Washington and makes it. And I do love the Eastern Washington grapes. They are beautiful. Yeah. It's nice that even on Vashon, which doesn't have a climate at all for wine producing. I mean, really, I guess there are some people that grow grapes here and produce it. What do you think about that?
So the Puget Lowlands is its own appellation that we have here on Vashon. And it is a lot more challenging because of our humidity. And we don't really have, we have nice dry summers. So there's good growing season, a lot of sun.
Yeah.
But during the spring and fall, it's very humid. And so we have a lot of problems with you know, molds and damaging the grapes.
Sure.
But yeah, the Columbia Plateau in Washington is just fantastic. So this is a large igneous province that formed 16 million years ago.
Say it again. It's a what?
A large igneous province. It's the youngest large igneous province on the planet.
What does that mean?
A large igneous province is where you have buoyancy going on at the core mantle boundary of the Earth's interior, and this light stuff, it becomes buoyant and it rises up, and as it rises up to near the surface, it melts, and you have massive outpourings of basalt lava. And this whole, usually it occurs along hotspots. So like Hawaii, this hotspot chain, it's because the plate is moving over this upwelling hotspot. And so when you have a large igneous province, you have like a mushroom head. The present-day hotspots are just mushroom tails. They're tiny little things. But where you have this massive amount of upwelling, you get massive amounts of eruption of lava. And the lavas can spread out over thousands of square kilometers and make millions of cubic kilometers of basalt. And the youngest one on the planet is right here in Washington and Oregon. And it formed 16 million years ago. If anyone has driven past Yakima, you see the beautiful. That's the youngest. So some other famous ones, the Siberian Traps are one of the biggest ones that formed 250 million years ago in Siberia. And that led to the extinction of 3/4 of the world's species because all this carbon dioxide was emitted into the atmosphere. And it caused climate change and extinctions of all these species. Just because of this huge eruption. Another one happened in India 65 million years ago, the Deccan Traps, when India was down here before it collided to form the Himalayas. And that coincided with the extinction of the dinosaurs because of the impact. So we had both a large igneous province form in India and the Chicxulub impact in Mexico that killed the dinosaurs together. And there's evidence that both of those processes had an impact. But yeah, India, in the high parts of India, you could grow grapes and you'd have the right conditions and climate and altitude temperatures. And
I'm going to have to Google that now and see if that's real.
Yeah, I bet you they've got some up there. But it's amazing.
And what do you think of the Australian wines?
Oh, I love Australian wines. Have you ever visited the Rutherglen Valley?
I've never been there.
It's the Rutherglen Valley is famous for their Tokais. And Tokai is a type of Hungarian dessert wine. And they've really perfected it in a place called the William Chambers Winery in the Rutherglen Valley.
Where exactly in Australia is that?
It's in South Australia, just north of Melbourne.
Okay.
Near Canberra. But it's this tiny little community, and they make the most amazing Tokais. You can get them locally. They export them.
Did you say it was a Hungarian dessert wine?
Well, the name Tokai comes from Hungary. Easternmost Hungary is the Tokai region, and that's where they started making these dessert wines. And
there a Hungarian population there that would have brought them?
Good question. When we were there visiting back in the 80s, and for a conference, and met the winemakers, and he told us a story about William Chambers. He entered his wine in the World's Fair in 1920, and it won. And since that time, they've taken some of the same wine from that vintage and added it to every successive vintage of and so the present day Tokays have a little bit of the 1920 vintages that won the World's Fair. But it's, yeah, I imagine it probably did because they call it Tokaj when that's really a Hungarian term.
I mean, I know there's like, there was like a big Italian population at some point. So, I mean, it would make sense.
So a lot of
people gravitate.
A lot of wine was spread around the world by missionaries and monks and because they needed the altar wine. And so a lot of grapevines were grown because of religion.
yeah, that does make sense.
But yeah, South Africa has some wonderful wines.
Do you like their wines?
Yes, I do. The Pinotage, and they've got some grapes that they don't really grow elsewhere until now. But yeah, Pinotage is one of these experiments that somebody was trying to blend Pinot Noir with another type of grape to get something that would grow in South Africa and their climate. And they came up with a wine that was totally different than
what does it taste
Pinot
like?
Noir. It's a lot heavier than Pinots.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they've got a different type of a flavor from South Africa. They're very unique.
I'm staring at a globe right in front of me. Steve was kind enough to bring one to keep us on track. So I'm sitting here looking at this and it's such a big, giant world, obviously. But
so yeah, you can see the southern limit coming through Argentina and Chile.
Mm-hmm. Have you been there?
No, I have not. My daughter just got back from Antarctica and Patagonia. So she's been there, but I haven't.
Well, there's
yet.
Time yet. Yeah. You can make
it. I'd love to go down there. But yeah, New Zealand has some wonderful wines, and that's right in our 30 to 50 degrees south latitudinal belt. And then Southern Australia has a lot, and the West. Tasmania has some wonderful wines too. The island down to the south of Australia.
And I'm a little bit lost for words trying to figure out all this. What about this region? I mean, you don't ever, I mean, I.
So China doesn't have a whole lot.
Yeah, but you said they're starting to produce.
Yeah, they are. Hopefully we'll see a lot more in the future. We'll see how they do. But yeah, the ban through the United States pretty much mimics the northern boundary of the U.S., although the Okanagan Valley in British Columbia has some wonderful wines.
God, and I would never think that wine would ever be produced there.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
They do a wonderful,
I mean, you always think
of
obviously the go-tos of old world wine, and then California and, you know, well... Steve, I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing this information with us.
My pleasure.
Yeah. I'm going to have to do some research here. I'm also going to have to go back to college and remember some geology and scientific tidbits.
Well, feel free to come to some of our seminars.
I will, absolutely.
When
are you guys doing them?
We're trying to do them every other month. And I think the next one is the end of March 21st.
And will she still be in the same location?
No, I think by that time she will have moved.
All right. So Steve Bergman, and he's going to be doing, what? Do you know what the topic is?
It's going to be on Mendoza and Salta. That's the third in a series of the geology of wine.
I love it. Thank you so much, Steve,
for
coming on.
Where we taste and then talk about
at the Vachon Wine Shop every other month. Check in with them to find the schedule. Thank you so much. This is Megan Hastings and the Cats and Jammer Follies on Voice of Vachon.
I'm praying for rain in California so the grapes can grow and they can make more wine. And I'm sitting in a honky in Chicago with a broken heart and a woman on my mind. I matched the man behind the bar for the jukebox, and the music takes me back to Tennessee. When they ask who's a fool in the corner,
I say, a little old wine drink of me. I came here last week from down in Nashville, 'cause my baby left for Florida on a train. I thought I'd get a job and just forget her, but in Chicago a broken heart is still the same. I matched the man behind the bar for the jukebox, and the music takes me back to Tennessee. When they ask who's a fool in a